Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Focus. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and we have a very special St. Patrick's Day treat this time. Our guest this week is one of the authors of Sons of St. Patrick, a history of the Archbishops of New York from Dagger John to Timmytown. There have been 10 Archbishops of New York, and every one of them has been Irish either by birth or by relatively immediate heritage. And with his author, with his co-author, Brad Miner, George J. Marlin has produced a history of these 10 men and their times, a most extraordinary book about America's really most important archdiocese over all of that time. Mr. Marlin is the author or editor of 13 books, including Narcissist Nation, Reflections of a Blue State Conservative. In 1993, Mr. Marlin was the Conservative Party nominee for the mayor of the city of New York. He served two terms as executive director and CEO of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. Mr. Marlin is also general editor of the collected works of G.K. Chesterton, and he serves now as chairman of Aid to the Church in Need USA. George J. Marlin, thank you so much for being with us today on Catholic Answers Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Before we go too far, I just want to ask you a quick question about Aid to the Church in Need, because people will maybe not know what that is. Or could you just give me a quick, as the chairman, what is Aid to the Church in Need, and maybe how could people support it?
Aid to the Church in Need USA is a Catholic charity under the guidance of the Pope, which is dedicated to helping persecuted and suffering Christians. For obvious reasons, we've been dedicating a lot of our time and effort and dollars into the Middle East in recent years, but Aid of the Church in Need was founded in 1948 by a Dutch Novitiane by the name of Father Werenfried van Straten. He was known as the Bacon Priest because Pius XII asked him to stop this charity and to go into Germany and Eastern Europe in the post-World War II period to help the starving people in those areas. So he had a barrel with bacon in it and used to hand out huge strips of bacon. And he built that into a charity today, which still flourishes. We have offices in 17 nations. We raise about $100 million a year, and we help persecuted Christians. And since the fall of the Iron Curtain, a lot of the energy has been directed to the Middle East and other areas around the world where Christians have been suffering or persecuted. So that's the kind of work we do, and we've been very active in the Middle East in recent years.
Aid to the Church in Need USA. So if someone, for example,
check our website.
Yep.
Your listeners could go right to our website. You'll see any of the stories we put up there, the horror stories of what's going on in the world right now and how Christians are truly the greatest persecuted religion in the world at this stage of the game.
And if, for example, we have a lot of people who ask us, well, how can I support, you know, say, Syrian Christians or Iraqi Christians, and you would be a good or Church of...
They could go to our website. They yep. could see projects that we're doing in various countries, particularly in the Middle East, Syria. I had the Archbishop of Aleppo, Syria, in the United States about a year and a half ago. We took him through the Northeast, raising money, doing television, and he made it clear that he walks in the steps of St. Peter and the Apostles in Aleppo, and he would not leave, and he is still there fighting, trying to rebuild the Catholic population in that area. So we have projects where people can select the projects they would like to help or donate to, so our website is, they'll find a very useful tool.
Very, very good. And, you know, when you just mentioning that, staying there in such a dangerous place as a Christian prelate, I have to say the early history of the first Catholics in New York, before we get to the 10 Irish men who led the archdiocese, before the archdiocese ever existed, this guy, Father Isaac, do you say it Jogues? Is that how you pronounce
it? Jogues, Father Jogues. It's amazing. You know, when I was a kid growing up in Brooklyn, I was 17 years in the Catholic educational system. The American history books we used to get from the nuns dealt with all these great saintly men and saints, like St. Isaac Jogues, and the sacrifices they made when the black robes came over. The first Jesuits came over, and Isaac Jogues arrived in New York. There were exactly two other Catholics, three, including himself. But he suffered greatly, left, came back to upstate New York, where he died as a martyr. And I remember the nuns teaching us that they cut off a lot of his fingers, the Indians, and the Pope gave him special permission, you know, on raising the host because he didn't have the two fingers you're supposed to use. It was a different time. But remarkable missionary that came and helped when the French first were here, settling New York State and Canada, et cetera. So it's just an extraordinary story of the missionary work that went on in the United States.
And that
100 years ago.
And Father Jogues was that's the 1640s. How long does it take until there's a substantial Catholic population in what we now know as New York City?
Well, really, even at the turn of the century into the 1800s, it was a very small population, although they had a political impact. I wrote a book called The American Catholic Vote, 200 Years of Political Impact, which sort of describes that as well. But let me point out one fact. In New York, even in the post-revolutionary time, until 1784, there was a state law that forbade priests from residing in New York State.
Wow.
They had a strong anti-Catholic, Anglo-Saxon, Anglican, / Episcopalian hatred of Catholics. And John Jay, one of our founding fathers, the first Chief Justice of the United States who lived in Lower Manhattan, despised Catholics. He used to march in the anti-Pope parade every day, every year. And when the Constitutional Convention met in New York State to create the New York State Constitution, he tried to get a clause put in there that said, you know, if you were a something to the Pope of Rome, if you were subject to the Pope of Rome, you could not hold office or be a citizen, etc. That the convention voted that down, but someone like John Jay, who we think of as the first Chief Justice of the United States, a blatant anti-Catholic. So it wasn't easy in the early years, let's put it that way.
And yet, Catholics do come to America, and they and bit by bit, these communities grow, and so we get to John Joseph Hughes. Can you tell us about John Joseph Hughes?
Sure.
That his
John
time
Joseph
period.
Was, yep. His he died in 1864. So he was born in Ireland, came over, first wanted to become a priest, and was down in St. Mary's Seminary down in Maryland. And then Bishop Dubois, who was the rector of it, later Bishop of New York, not an archbishop, but the last Bishop of New York, he wouldn't let John Hughes enter the seminary, thought he wasn't particularly educated, and he was the gardener. He was the gardener at the seminary. So we call him the gardener, not only because he was the first to start building the archdiocese of New York, but he was literally a gardener. And Bishop Dubois visited him in his little shack he lived off on the grounds of the seminary and realized he was studying Latin and quizzed him and realized this guy had a first-class mind and educated himself and permitted him to enter the seminary. Make a long story short, he winds up a priest in Philadelphia, winds up co-adjutor bishop in New York under Bishop Dubois. And when Dubois died, he became Bishop of New York and shortly thereafter became the first Archbishop of New York. Now, John Hughes, Dagger John Hughes, as you call him, I'll get to that in a minute, was what I call a bomb thrower. He did not fear the anti-Catholics, the nativist movements of the 1820s and 40s, the anti-Masonic movement, which is really an anti-Catholic movement, the Know-Nothing movement in the early 1850s. And when the anti-Catholic nativists were burning down churches in Philadelphia, in particular in 1848, he went to the mayor of New York, who was an anti-Catholic nativist, and said, here's the deal. If one church burns, Catholic church burns in New York City, I can promise you that New York City will look like Moscow in 1812 when Napoleon left that city, retreated from that city, and burnt it down. Well, they took him seriously, and they backed off. So he was not afraid to pick a fight with any of the anti-Catholics, particularly the educational system of the city, which was controlled by Protestants, and they used the Protestant Bible in the school. He wanted equal treatment. When he couldn't get it, he started building the Catholic educational system, which became a huge system of the city and state of New York. But the name Dagger John goes back to the fact that, as you know, a bishop, when he signs his name to this day, puts a little cross before his name. And when he had public proclamations or statements published in local newspapers, the only kind of print they had to put that cross was a little dagger. And so he became known as Dagger John Hughes. And the anti-Catholics thought that dagger was aimed right at their throats. And even during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln turned to him on a number of occasions, sent him overseas to Europe to meet with heads of state and Catholic heads of state on the president's behalf. urging them not to recognize the Confederacy and to stay with the Union. Lincoln sent a letter to Rome asking that Pope to bestow on Archbishop Hughes a red hat, which did not happen. Hughes died in 1864. But during the great draft riots of 1863, Catholics, the draft was unfairly skewed towards Catholic neighborhoods during the Civil War. The Anglo-Saxon Protestant neighborhoods, you know, they might be drafted 1 in 10, while in the Catholic districts, it was 6 or 7 or 8 out of 10. And at that time, people with money, mostly Protestants, Anglo-Saxons, could buy their way out of the draft by paying an Irishman $200, paying somebody $200. It's interesting. President Theodore Roosevelt's father, Theodore Roosevelt the Elder, paid someone $200, an Irishman, to take his place. President Franklin Roosevelt's father, James Roosevelt, paid an Irishman $200 to take his place in the draft. So the unfairness of this erupted in July of 1863, and there were Irish riots that began to dominate throughout the city, and it was Archbishop Hughes who called them together and calmed the city and put out a proclamation. He was on his deathbed, literally, but came out to his, you know, his stoop of his residence and lectured thousands of Irish who gathered and said, this must come to an end. And that brought peace back to the city. So he had a remarkable impact. He was the bomb thrower.
Yep.
His successor, Archbishop McCluskey, was the first who came out of Brooklyn, was the first, John Joseph McCluskey, was the first archbishop to receive a cardinal's hat from the Pope in the United States. And obviously in New York, but the United States, even though Baltimore was sort of the premier seat, because that was the original seat,
well, before
it was New York that got the first red hat.
But before we move to Cardinal McCluskey, John Hughes, Dagger John, kind of set a pattern for American prelates as political leaders, really, because they were looked to as the person who could defend the immigrant Catholic population against American nativism. Isn't that – he kind of set a pattern there.
Well, he said – and again, of the 10 archbishops, each fit their times, and we'll briefly get into each and some of them just to give you some idea how they complemented one another at the time. But yes, he stood up for persecuted Catholics in New York and became a symbol for the nation and gave backbone to other bishops. The Bishop of Philadelphia, Bishop Kendrick, was considered by many historians a weak guy and sort of, you know, panicked when the riots hit Philadelphia first. But it was Hughes who showed them how to lead the way and gave backbone to other bishops in the United States to stand up against these forces. So he had a moral authority, and he had, we'll use the word political, because the numbers of Catholics, particularly in America's major inner city, New York being the biggest, also had considerable clout at the voting booth. And so he parlayed that to say, you know, if you give us grief, we're going to turn out against you as well. So yes, he was a symbol, he was a man of action, and he was not afraid to use his clout, his moral authority, and to drum up support from Catholics as they became citizens and were voting in the city of New York and elsewhere throughout the state.
And so he dies in the midst of the Civil War and
tail end of the Civil War.
And then comes John Joseph McCluskey.
McCluskey was a very different guy, more low-key. And it's interesting, it's analogous to present times. McCluskey, great bomb thrower, great fighter he was. He started St. Patrick's Cathedral. He bought the land, which was farmland, up on what is now Fifth Avenue, the highest rent district probably in the world for real estate. A lot of people thought he was crazy at the time. But he began the building of the cathedral, and there were just the columns up when the war broke out. When McCluskey died, the place was pretty much broke. So McCluskey took a more low-key role, was well-respected and revered by the community as a whole, political community, Protestant establishment, a very decent guy, was not afraid to work with people, but he started raising the money to start building the infrastructure of the church in New York, but particularly St. Patrick's Cathedral, which was completed and dedicated in 1879. So he was more low-key. It's an interesting contrast to, say, Cardinal O'Connor of New York, a very good friend of mine. We worked together on fighting the culture wars. Cardinal O'Connor, like Hughes, was a great bomb thrower, stood up to the forces in New York City, which are incredible, the secular forces, which I'm sure we'll get into. But his successor was Cardinal Egan, who was also a very good friend. And I spent a lot of time with Cardinal Egan in the last 2 years of his life in writing this book. But Egan inherited a financial mess from O'Connor. O'Connor was a great man, and I revered, but I attributed to him working for the federal government, 28 years in the Navy, that he didn't like fundraising, and he didn't look, he knew how to spend money, but didn't know how to raise money. Egan was much more low-key, like McCluskey, and looked to McCluskey as his model. And he inherited a $20 million deficit. He had $200 million worth of debt. So he began, he paid off all those debts, worked quietly behind the scenes to rebuild the archdiocese, to keep schools open, to keep churches open, and worked on the finances and the spirituality of the archdiocese. So, again, he fit his times. McCluskey fit his times after you. So that's how it's traditionally it's worked out. Each guy was different.
Yep.
Each guy, however, had certain strengths that was perfect for his own time.
Now, was McCluskey one? There were two of the archbishops of New York who were actually born in Ireland.
That was Archbishop Hughes and Cardinal Fawley.
Oh, okay. So McCluskey was
born. The others were descendants, generally, you know, first generation born in the United States.
And so he was a New Yorker?
Yeah.
And
Corrigan, who succeeded him, was born in Newark, but we'll call him a New Yorker.
Okay.
McCluskey was born in Brooklyn, actually. McCluskey was born in Brooklyn.
But, okay, so he's born in Brooklyn. He knows New York, and the church is maturing a little bit during his period there because these waves of particularly Irish immigration now have—
Irish and German. The big flux was Irish.
Uh-huh.
Then in the 1850s, late 40s, you had a German influx that grew greater— in 1870, when Bismarck took over in the consolidation, there was the Kulturkampf in Germany. So, you know, to give you some ideas, you know, between 1871 and 1880, you know, 175,000 Germans came over, 180,000 Irish, but only 4,000 from Poland. So by the 20th century, give you an idea, and between 1901 and 1910, 500,000 came from the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. Germany dropped down to 36,000. Italy, 802,000. From Poland, 608,000. From Ireland, 10,000. So the Irish-German influx was, you know, 1840s through the 1870s. And then the Eastern European, Italians and Poles, started coming heavily into the city at the turn of the 20th century. That's basically the breakdown. So it was, for instance, Cardinal Fawley, during his time, created a lot of the ethnic parishes, as we came to know. I grew up in a neighborhood that was Irish and Polish. I went to, taught by the Polish nuns, Sisters of the Holy Family in Nazareth, the St. Cyril and Methodius. You had in my old neighborhood in Brooklyn, Greenpoint, St. Cyril's, which was a Polish parish, St. Stanislaus Kostka, which is still standing, and that was where St. John Paul stayed several times as Cardinal Archbishop of Krakow when he would visit the United States. Matter of fact, I was there this past Sunday, seeing a nun who taught me in the eighth grade 51 years ago. She was the principal of St. Stan's and taught me years ago, but I gave her a copy of the book and sat with her. So these were the ethnic neighborhoods. So Fawley, who was Archbishop, Cardinal Archbishop from 1902 to 1919, and during his time, he built 38 Italian parishes, 13 Italian chapels, Italian priesthood quadrupled up to close to 100 Italian priests. So again, you had the ethnic influx, and you began to see Polish parishes, even French parishes in New York City.
So with this, with these waves
parishes,
of different immigration that come in, but it all kind of starts with the Irish, that is the Catholic population. Is that why you think all 10 archbishops of New York have been Irish, because they were so well-established?
The Irish dominated. You got to remember, the Irish were generations ahead of the other ethnic groups.
Right.
So typically, from again, you saw this nationally. I get into this more detail in my book on the American Catholic voter. Typically speaking, first generation of poor, they worked in neighborhoods. The Irish, who had a great, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan had a genius for organization, began organizing the local political clubs, the political organizations. It was worked around the parishes, the neighborhoods. It was really, they instinctively knew subsidiarity in building from the bottom up. So they were generations ahead of the other ethnic groups that started coming in terms of education, in terms of employment, in terms of political organization. So the Irish dominated not only the church in New York, they dominated the political situation. You know, Al Smith, who became governor of New York, who I think was New York's greatest governor, the first to run for president, Catholic run president in 1928, he was part of the Boris Murphy's organization. Senator yep. Wagner came out of that. He was Irish and German. So when you look at the mayors of New York, once Catholics dominated the city, heavily Irish, Jimmy Walker, mayor of New York, Bob Hope did a movie on him years ago playing Mayor Jimmy Walker. The Irish dominated the political situation, and so they dominated the church, and they also became the money people that gave great dollars to the church as they went up the economic ladder. So, yes, that's why we have the St. Patrick's Cathedral.
So John Joseph Hughes...
Not St. Stanislaus Cathedral.
Right, exactly. John Joseph Hughes then has to fight for a place for Catholics at the table in New York, and he does, getting the name Dagger John in the process. He's followed by John Joseph McCloskey, first cardinal of New York. By 1885, he has built St. Patrick's Cathedral, and he has really established the church in New York. So next comes Michael Corrigan. So Michael Corrigan, the third Archbishop of New York, 1873 to 1902. Tell us about him.
Well, Corrigan, who was born in Newark, then wound up in New York, which was fine. We'll let people come across the river. If you notice tolls in New York, I was head of the Port Authority in New York and New Jersey, and in addition to overseeing the airport, we have the bridges and tunnels that connect New York and Jersey over the Hudson or under the Hudson. You'll notice you have to pay the toll coming into New York. When you leave New York, you don't have to pay a toll, but you have to pay a toll coming in. So we consider it a privilege for people to be able to, they have to pay for the privilege of coming into New York.
Having said that,
Corrigan continued to build the church and the church structure, and he was a very solid guy. But we had the battle of Americanism during that time, where not unlike some of the battles we face today, where a number of bishops and other lay Catholics thought the church must conform to American norms and that we have to sell out to a secular America on a host of issues. And Corrigan led the charge against that. And Pope Leo XIII put out a statement to the American Catholics condemning Americanism.
Right.
So he was a great fighter in that sense with this internal battle with the church. And because he said he can get the red hat, he's the only archbishop, except for Hughes, of course, after McCloskey, got the red hat not to get it. But these battles got pretty ugly. And even in New York, there were priests on both sides of the issue. But Corrigan was solid as a rock. And that is his legacy, that he fought the Americanism battle. And while still building the church and doing everything, solid guy. But that's what he's remembered for. So he dies in 1902, I think. Folly, who was a protege of his, became, I think, the first auxiliary bishop of New York. Folly becomes the archbishop, becomes cardinal in the early 1900s. He then deals with this great influx of Eastern Europeans and Italians coming to the nation. And so, as I mentioned earlier, he began building the ethnic parishes in New York City and the growth of the school system. We called him the builder. He really built the Catholic parochial school system in New York, the Catholic high school system in New York. He did a remarkable job. He built Dunwoody, got it paid off, the seminary, St. Joseph's Seminary, and did a remarkable job. He also sponsored the Catholic Encyclopedia. He put the corporation together and put together the writers, etc. That, if you remember, the original Catholic Encyclopedia, which is probably about 15 volumes. So he was trying to upgrade the intellectual side of Catholicism in New York, tried to build up Dunwoody with intellectual teachers there. There were battles that too. And so Farley, and then, of course, with the outbreak of the First World War, the Pope wanted a military archbishop to have to spiritually guide the American Catholics who entered the army.
And so Farley died.
The honor went to New York. Pardon me?
Farley died in the midst.
1919.
So at the very end then of the First World War.
Yeah. Well, what Farley did, he started working with the KSC and others to establish all these quote unquote Catholic clubhouses within the army domestically in the United States to give troops places to go and get spiritual guidance and to get a hot cup of coffee. He subbed that down to an auxiliary, Patrick Hayes. Now, Hayes, when he became a priest, probably in the 1870s, was assigned to a parish that Monsignor Farley had. And Farley saw in this guy a very talented administrator, brought him along with him. He became Archbishop of the Auxiliary Bishop of New York. Hayes became his priest secretary. When he became Archbishop of New York, Hayes was his priest secretary and later chancellor of the archdiocese. He knew the mechanics of the archdiocese. Farley subbed to him to be the military bishop. So Farley also did a lot of traveling in the United States and to Europe and organizing the chaplains, Catholic chaplains, that were in the service during that period. Because remember the movie, The Fighting 69th, where Pat O'Brien played Father Duffy. Father Duffy, although Canadian, was a priest of the Archdiocese of New York and became famous during the First World War, and there's still the statue of him in Times Square of Father Duffy. But he reported to Hayes. So Hayes becomes the Archbishop of New York in 1919. Hayes we call the bureaucrat. He was not a public guy. He was not a great speaker. He didn't like mixing with top brass, the important people of the city of New York, political class. He was more an inside guy, a bureaucrat who knew how the place worked. And his contribution was that he realized the various charitable institutions in New York, the sort of Catholic ones, were going all over the place. He consolidated them together and created Catholic Charities, which was the model for the nation of what we call Catholic Charities today in every diocese. And that was his greatest interest. And what was interesting about it is that when the Depression hit 1929, the Catholic Church became a major factor in servicing and helping the faithful who were suffering during the Depression. He became very good friends with Al Smith. He was not a public guy, but he called his shots from time to time. He took on Margaret Sanger, who was up in New York and preaching birth control, etc., took her on. When the Marxists took over the Mexican government, interesting, going through the archives, I should point out that Cardinal Dolan opened up to my partner and I, Brad Minor, the archives at the seminary. So we had an opportunity to go through, 150 years worth of documents and things. But Cardinal Hayes was appalled by the Marxists and Mexican, how they were persecuting the church. I read telegrams of protest and outrage he sent to President Coolidge and Secretary of State Kellogg at the time. He organized the bishops of the United States to put out statements condemning what was going on in Mexico, helping priests to escape. So he called the shot, but he became very good friends with Governor Franklin Roosevelt, then President Roosevelt. And interesting, Hayes, who was born in Lower Manhattan, went to LaSalle Academy, which no longer exists, but Catholic high school run by the Christian Brothers in Lower Manhattan. He then went to Manhattan College in the Bronx, which was run by the Christian Brothers. His closest friend in high school and college was George Mundelein, who also had a vocation, but he didn't stay in New York as Hayes did. He went to a seminary in Pennsylvania, and as Hayes became Cardinal Archbishop of New York, Mundelein, his best friend, became the first Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago. Remarkable. Two guys went together to high school and college together in the late 19th century.
And Patrick
so
Hayes, I just wanted to say, it strikes me as you speak about Cardinal Hayes that one of the qualities of being Archbishop of New York, and maybe at this time, maybe more than ever, I don't know, is also as a cultural leader, as to, they've kind of been the leaders of, like, even his standing up to Mexico or his creating Catholic Charities. There's a way in which these men, these archbishops of New York, took on a cultural leadership for American Catholicism. Is that about right?
Oh, yeah. It is true. They were looked for, you know, St. John Paul put it best when he said, New York is the capital of the world. It's also, since the 1920s, the center of the media of this nation. So an Archbishop of New York is expected to be called on to not only state things right, be a cultural factor within the city and the state. He also has this huge operation where New York City was built, New York Archdiocese was built into 400 parishes, several hundred grammar schools, scores of high schools, Catholic colleges, etc. So you're overseeing a huge plan. Think about it, 400, just 400 churches alone. What it takes to keep an eye and make sure all these things are running on time, so keep the trains running on time, so to speak. So it's a huge job. And so you're not only, you got to keep a lot of balls in the air. That's why, you know, when Hayes dies in 1939, Pius XII becomes Pope in 1939, and he appoints his very good friend, Francis Spellman, who was originally from Boston, spent time, he was the first American to have a job in the Vatican. Spellman spent 28 years as Archbishop of New York. He was truly, as Cardinal Dolan called him, I did a show with Cardinal Dolan last week, called him the Archbishop of America, which is very true.
Right. Yep.
Spellman was an unassuming guy, 5'5", balding, plump. And the key was great men saw things in him. President Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, pardon me, Winston Churchill, General Eisenhower, then President Eisenhower, President Johnson. They saw something in this man. And in addition to running this huge plant I just described, he, as military archbishop, traveled 1,000,000 miles or more during the Second World War, not only ministering to the troops around the world, our troops, but carrying on missions for the president. You know, it's interesting, in 1942, here we are at war with Germany and Italy, and Franklin Roosevelt was able to get a pass for Archbishop Spellman to go through the enemy lines and go to the Vatican, ostensibly to talk to the Pope about church matters in the United States. Spellman played a great conduit between Pope Pius and Franklin Roosevelt during the war. He was sort of the back door. There's a book of a volume of a book called The Letters of Pius and Franklin Roosevelt, but that tells the public story. Then there's the backdoor story, which Spellman was the key player. So here he is running this huge plant. Here he is running around the world. Here he is being a conduit between popes and presidents, keeping all these balls in the air at one time. And in the post-World War II era, in addition to keeping on his duties as military archbishop, you know, Catholicism exploded in the post-World War II period. It was the anti-communism Cold War. Anti-communism was our issue, the Catholic issue. And, you know, when I was studying philosophy years ago in college, I always took a course in philosophy of communism because we knew how to fight the Marxists. And it's interesting, in 1948, on March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, there is the oldest annual dinner in New York is the Friendly Friends of St. Patrick's. I will be at that dinner tomorrow night. 4,000 men in tuxedos drinking, and on St. Patrick's Day, and the Archbishop of New York presides over that dinner. In 1948, President Harry Truman spoke at that dinner, basically declared his candidacy for re-election, and declared what a strong anti-communist he was, condemning Henry Wallace, who was going to be the Progressive Party candidate for president, as soft on communism. So Spellman had that kind of ability to command that kind of attention that a president of the United States came to the biggest Catholic dinner in the nation, basically to say, I'm running for re-election, and my platform will be anti-communism. So Spellman is the exception of exceptions. He was remarkable.
He was probably the, would you say
everything
he was...
Everything else they did plus more and managed to manage it beautifully.
And would you say, and as a matter of fact, I think you might have already said it, but Spellman is the most powerful bishop in the history of the United States.
most powerful, most visible. He was, we call him the power broker. He was in the 40s and 50s and 60s. The Cardinal's residence, which is on Madison Avenue on the backside of St. Patrick, was called the powerhouse, and it was rightfully so. Presidents, governors, mayors, congressmen, they'd always check in with the Archbishop of New York before they did something that concerned that might affect the church or Catholic values, the Catholic voters. Right.
But we can't move off of Spellman without, at least for a moment, before we move to Cardinal Cook, mentioning that he promoted Fulton Sheen and was and fostered the career of Fulton Sheen, and then the two of them had a major falling out over powdered milk.
That is correct. It went a little deeper than that. He made Sheen, when he brought him as auxiliary of New York, auxiliary bishop, made him auxiliary bishop of New York. The television show started in New York, Life is Worth Living. Sheen made him head of the propagation of the faith, because Sheen raised tens of millions of dollars, gave all his royalties from his books to the propagation of the faith. But their first clashes were over money. I had an opportunity to speak to Archbishop Sheen's secretary when he was head of the propagate priest secretary, who was still alive. So they had arguments over money. You know, Sheen, you know, there was a procedure for them to get grants and do things. Spellman was like, you know, just send me a check, and it didn't quite work that way. So they had run-ins then. And then over the powdered milk, President Eisenhower donated a ton of powdered milk to Spellman to use, give to the poor, etc. Spellman gave it to the propagation of the faith and demanded some repayment and for it. Sheen said no. To make a long story short, it became such a controversy that Rome heard about it. Pius XII called them over. Turned out that Sheen was right in this argument, and Spellman was not a happy camper. And you know, according to one of his biographers, Sheen's biographers, Reeves, you know, stated that, you know, I'll get you someday. Sheen's show went off the air shortly thereafter. He stopped doing the Seven Last Words on Good Friday in New York. He was doing it in Newark, the cathedral in Newark. And Sheen, Spellman was very concerned that when he was getting on in years, he didn't want Sheen to become Archbishop of New York. So he convinced Rome to make him the Bishop of the Diocese of Rochester, New York. Quite frankly, Sheen was a complete fool. He was not made to be an administrator and a ordinary of a diocese. It was a disaster up there. He retired when he hit 75.
Yeah.
So that's one of the sad chapters. Interestingly enough, when Sheen died on December 9th, 1979, I received a call from someone in the communications department of the archdiocese saying, do you have, you know, I had a great interest in Sheen. I did a book called The Quotable Sheen back in the 80s. Cardinal O'Connor wrote the introduction to. But I said, yeah, I have a collection of pictures here. I said, you need a picture of the communications department of the archdiocese. Well, as I was told, when Spellman put you on the X list, everything was cleaned up.
Oh.
But Cardinal Cook made up for it when he announced on December 10th, 1979, that Sheen's funeral would be in St. Patrick's Cathedral, which I attended, and would be buried under the crypt of the main altar where the archbishops of New York were buried. So the irony of it is the person buried next to Spellman in that crypt is Fulton Sheen.
So tell us about Terence James Cook, the seventh Archbishop of New York, 1968 to 1993.
Cardinal Cook, again, was an inside guy, grew up in the Bronx. He was secretary to Spellman. He was not a theologian by background. He was a social worker by background. I had the pleasure of knowing him. He was a very low-key, non-controversial guy. And when I say the contrast, Spellman had the good sense. The good Lord called him in December of 1967, just as everything was going crazy. The post-Vatican II craziness, the Vietnam War craziness, the college campuses blowing up. Everything seemed to be in turmoil at the late 60s, early 70s. Cook becomes the Archbishop of New York. It was a surprise because it was coadjutor Archbishop, who, although he did not have rights to succession, Archbishop McGuire. McGuire expected it, but Cook got it. He was only 48 years old. I think he was the youngest Archbishop at the time in the United States and became a cardinal at 50, I think. He was the right guy for the right time. Keep this in mind. The day he is installed as Archbishop of New York, Martin Luther King is assassinated. He leaves the reception after his ceremony at St. Patrick's, goes up with the mayor of New York to Harlem, preaches from a Harlem church, preaching peace and calm because there were riots and breakouts going on. 6 weeks later, Bobby Kennedy, junior senator from the state of New York, is assassinated in California after the California primary. He's laid out in St. Patrick's, the first non-cleric since Alfred E. Smith, laid out there when he died in October 1944. You know, great controversy. 6 weeks later, Humanae Vitae comes down from Paul VI. Cook was solid as a rock on doctrine, but as you know, there was a great upheaval in many places, including many priests. He had a seminary where there was mutiny going on. And he, in his own quiet way, he was not a bomb throw. He was solid as a rock on doctrine. Let's let some little things fall through the cracks. I came across a picture when I was doing my research of Cook at a mass in Harlem where they were playing jazz music. And you could see the look on his face like, what am I doing here? But he let those things happen because he was more concerned about the bigger picture. He was a consensus guy. He was not too hot, not too cold, but he was solid on doctrine. He was the military archbishop, solid on those issues as well. And he died young, 62, of cancer, but he also showed New Yorkers how to die. It's interesting. He would do, say, midnight mass at the cathedral on Christmas Eve, then take off for Vietnam or Korea, wherever he was ministering to troops as military archbishop. But he would get a blood transfusion before he'd leave. And nobody knew about the extent of his illness. And so he sort of showed us how to die as well. And so he was solid. We fought various things in New York City, like the gay rights bill and other things, which he helped defeat. He was solid as a rock, but low-key, and he was the right guy for the times. And one area of the book to read, in particular, several days before his death, Ronald Reagan visited Cardinal Cook at his residence. President and Mrs. Reagan went up. And there is, in the book, I was given a copy of a memo Monsignor Charles McDonough wrote right after that meeting, describing everything that took place. Cardinal O'Brien gave that to me. So I quote that extensively, and that's the first time it's revealed what exactly took place. So it's interesting reading. It's page 282 in the book, but you get a sense of, you know, you were there.
Yep.
When Ronald Reagan came up very quietly.
George J. Marlin is our guest today on Catholic Answers Focus, Sons of St. Patrick, a history of the Archbishops of New York from Dagger John to Timmytown. George, we only have a few minutes left, so can you take us through O'Connor, Egan, and then the present Cardinal.
Possibly the last Irishman, but certainly the present.
Right.
I'll be as quick as I can.
Okay, just – yeah.
What do we have left?
Yeah, a few minutes, so take us through those last three.
Cardinal Cook dies. Who's appointed? A collaborator of his in the military, Archbishop Bishop Cook, Bishop O'Connor. He becomes Archbishop. He was an admiral in the Navy for 28 years. He's like John Hughes, a bomb thrower. And he took battles on. And what's interesting reading this book is battles particularly with Mario, his run-ins with Mario Cuomo. Mario Cuomo, I knew since 1970. I grew up in Queens politics. I knew his Queens lawyer. I know his son since he's 17. Mario was very smart. He was once pro-life. He gave it all up when he lost a couple of runs of public office, particularly mayor of New York. Sort of flipped on us, but tried to intellectually rationalize his position. O'Connor and he fought time and again. And when you connect all the dots and people forget a lot of things, I put it all together, and O'Connor beat him at every turn. O'Connor was the great fighter. He was not afraid to take on the mayor of New York, the governor of New York, the establishment. And he was remarkable for his times. And, however, he was not the greatest administrator in running the diocese. So when he passed away, died of cancer, his successor is Edward Egan, Cardinal Egan. And Egan was more, much like McCluskey, very low-key, inherited a deficit, inherited a lot of debt. He sort of rebuilt the archdiocese, and in my judgment, did a very fine job, and sometimes gets a bum rap because you can't follow acts like Hughes or O'Connor. If you try to be like them, the press will criticize you. But when you say, listen, my job is different here, I'm going to be concerned about the faithful and the structure of the church, he was criticized, but he brought the place back, paid off the debts, and left his successor. Now, he was the first one not to die in office. He said, and so he left his successor, Timothy Cardinal Dolan, a place that was in pretty good shape. Today, we call Dolan the evangelist because it's a very different world. You can't be O'Connor, yet you got to be out there publicly. And while the Archbishop of New York doesn't have the political clout he had once had because of the changing demographic, the secular world, fall away Catholics, Dolan, like Egan, still has considerable moral authority. And when governors and mayors get in a fix, they turn to the Archbishop. They don't turn to the Episcopal Archbishop of New York. They turn to the Cardinal Archbishop of New York. When New York City almost was inflamed during the O'Connor period, when a young Hispanic was beaten up by some cops, died, the Diallo situation, it was Cardinal O'Connor who had a prayer session in St. Patrick with all faith and all sides of the argument and brought peace to the city. Egan did it similarly after 9/11. He was ministering to Catholics. He ran the prayer service at Yankee Stadium, masses at St. Patrick's Cathedral, running around the city. He, too, helped bring peace to the city during that trying period. Most recently, Cardinal Dolan, when we had a person, an African-American, who was locked up by cops in Staten Island, which is a very Catholic part of New York City, this person died while on the way to be taken to jail. That became a huge controversy in the city. All the people came out of the Al Sharptons of the world. The city was, you know, on the brink, possibly, of riots. Mayor de Blasio, no friend of the church, present mayor of New York, turned to Cardinal Dolan, who brought all the players into his residence, and then again had a prayer session like O'Connor at St. Patrick's Cathedral to bring peace to the city. So the Archbishop of New York doesn't have the clout he used to have, but he still has moral authority, and if you use it at the right time, the Archbishop is still a factor in New York City. 200 years since it became a diocese, and we had Dagger John Hughes at the helm of the church.
George Marlin, thanks so much for this, walking through the history of these Sons of St. Patrick's with us for St. Patrick's Day here on Catholic Answers Focus.
All righty. Thank you.
And have a happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thanks so much. You too. Bye-bye.
Sons of St. Patrick is the book, A History of the Archbishops of New York from Dagger John to Timmytown. It's available now from Ignatius Press. I am Cy Kellett, your host. This is Catholic Answers Focus. Thanks for being with us this week. We'll see you again next week.